Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Fit Nation, The Gains and Pains of America's Exercise Obsession by Natalia Melman Petrozella. Narrated by Natalia Melman Petrozella. In memory of Patricia Moreno, who taught me that the most powerful lessons we learn in the gym are those we take into the world. Author's note. This book was born at the gym, or to be more exact, just outside it, on a crisp evening in 2011. Hair and tank top still damp from the exercise class I had just taught at Equinox, a high-end New York City fitness chain, I was reflecting on a breathless conversation with a student. As I was packing up, she ran over, words spilling forth. Thanks to this class, I don't even need therapy anymore, and I'm having the best sex. She gushed with an abandon that, 5 years into teaching fitness, had become strangely familiar. In emails, on social media, or after class, students shared predictable triumphs such as fitting into their jeans or completing a marathon, but also disclosed surprisingly, and even troublingly, private details about their pregnancies, mental health, and sexual experiences. The intensity of the authority and intimacy these people, attorneys and account managers and editors and executives, projected onto me was unexpected and a bit unsettling. After all, I knew most of them only by first name, and I had only the most basic fitness credentials. But who was I to judge anyone for getting a little starry-eyed thanks to an inspiring sweat? My own experience of exercise, after all, had been so transformative that I had embarked on a shadow fitness career alongside my job as a history professor, teaching exercise classes before and after work several days a week. I was ruminating on whether some students were unhealthily invested in their workouts as I traversed Union Square, a neighborhood some would soon dub Fit Die, that's fitness district, thanks to the concentration of yoga studios, juice bars, and athleisure shops that signaled the affluence of its population. A group of mostly Black and Latino teenagers talked and laughed as they strode past the stalls spilling over with bunches of kale and artisanal sourdough loaves, heading for the increasingly anomalous McDonald's, which has since shut. They were almost certainly students at Washington Irving, also since shuttered, an enormous but under-resourced high school one block east, which was a relic of early 20th century faith in large public institutions to transform the lives of the poor. Washington Irving students were about as unlikely to be members of Equinox as to attend the private four-year liberal arts college where I taught, also only blocks away. As the scene vividly revealed, bodies, like homes, bank accounts, neighborhoods, and the number of diplomas on the wall, are yet another marker of socioeconomic inequality. My passion for fitness had, up until that evening, existed largely apart from my jobs as a middle school Spanish teacher and then as a historian of education. For the first time, a few months later, I brought these pursuits together. Co-founding with food justice activist Ellen Gustafson, Health Class 2.0, an experiential partnership between the New School and the Washington Irving Educational Complex. Over 5 years, we expanded to collaborate with principals, teachers, health educators, students, and local businesses to serve over 5,000 youth in three boroughs. My college students, Ellen and I, would drag our stereo and boxes of snacks to physical education classes and after-school programs, co-creating a curriculum that enabled engaged, even pleasurable, experiences of healthful food and exercise, as well as strategies to integrate these practices into daily life independently and affordably. Many wellness education programs already existed, and even more do today. But our key contribution was to set common advice about making healthy choices in the context of the structural factors that can make fast food more economical than healthier alternatives and access to the time and space to exercise a privilege. This book emerged from that activism, a quest to understand how fitness has evolved to represent far more than physical exertion, to be connected to a set of values that privileges the individualistic, disciplined pursuit of health, or at least its outward appearance, as a virtue, and to transpire in spaces not universally accessible, challenging some inequalities and intensifying others. I did not arrive at this project naturally. I grew up in the Boston suburbs in the 1980s and 90s, and I felt intimidated by, averse to, and apathetic about the exercise activities available to me, sports and dance. All seemed to require talent and technique that I lacked, and in auditions and tryouts where other kids shone, I only envisioned embarrassment. Short-lived, lackluster forays into ballet and lacrosse only affirmed my antipathy. But the activity I most despised was the required one, physical education. As a bookish kid, unfailingly last on the rope climb and mile run, and even at hopping up on the bleachers before class began, I invented every excuse to escape this obligation. My salvation came when I learned I could obtain course credit for participating in an unspecified, supervised physical activity. Annoyed, the department head reproached me. That does not include team sports. No problem. In 1994, my options were hiring a personal trainer, that's for rich people, my parents rebuffed, or participating in an activity included with our family membership to the Jewish Community Center, group fitness class. I suited up in lime green Umbro shorts and an oversized t-shirt decorated with dancing Grateful Dead bears and tentatively walked into step aerobics. The youngest by at least a decade, I hung in the back, marveling at the synchronized movement of the men and mostly women. Before long, I was at the front, my reflection a version of myself I barely recognized, spinning around the molded rubber and plastic Reebok step, purple risers stacked ever higher, new muscles visible under the tight bike shorts and sports bra I'd bought at the mall. After class, I felt breathless, strong, and ready for anything, or at least for my homework and high school social drama. I had discovered fitness, not sport, and its codes, rituals, and hierarchies, which I somehow felt more capable of navigating. I didn't yet know the vocabulary of self-care or wellness, but I knew I was hooked on the exhilarating feeling that overtook me when the 32-count workout music piped up and I focused only on mastering choreography. I also didn't realize that I had entered that studio at a moment when the fitness industry was expanding dramatically, both in market size and in the ever loftier promises it made to a clientele increasingly encompassing more than bodybuilders and so-called gym rats. Over the coming years, I experienced that expansion firsthand. In order to take free classes while in college, I worked the reception desk at a world gym. Handing out towels and swiping cards, I observed the twin spectacles of New Yorkers sculpting their bodies and of a franchise frantically attempting to compete with the sleek new health clubs that featured aerobics classes, cardio machines, and yoga mats rather than iron barbells. I moved to California and found a recreational running culture more inclusive than anything I had seen back east, and the presence of people of all ages and sizes paired with the opportunity to fundraise for leukemia and lymphoma research and warm weather inspired me to run my first marathon. I became certified to teach Intensati, a fitness class that combined aspects of martial arts, dance, and yoga, and was hired at Equinox, an expensive chain with a self-serious motto. It's not fitness, it's life. When my classes filled, I was chosen as a brand ambassador for yoga-inspired retailer Lululemon Athletica, a huge poster of my pregnant body swathed in expensive stretchy fabric hanging on the store wall, a reminder that spending on exercise and its accoutrements was a socially acceptable form of conspicuous consumption during the Great Recession. My students often asked how I could smile so broadly while teaching such hard classes so early in the morning. And I would truthfully say that I was in disbelief, given my anxieties about my insufficient athleticism, that rooms full of people regularly showed up to exercise with me. But I was also a scholar, and my personal satisfaction at my participation in the fitness world didn't explain how fitness had become so central to the American ideal of self-fashioning, yet remained in so many ways undeniably exclusive. My enthusiasm for fitness always coexisted with a profound unease about the destructive dynamics present in essentially every exercise activity. Access was far from the only problem. Step may have saved me from the humiliations of PE, but it was in those mirrored studios that I learned to scrutinize and name every inch of my body. Thunder thighs, muffin top, as a present or potential problem area to be slimmed or more violently blasted, especially after enjoying rich food, I came to moralize as a guilty pleasure, especially in advance of bikini season, which I simply used to call summer. I still don't know whether my joy derived from the sweaty exhilaration of class or from meeting the internalized expectation to constantly work on myself. But I sometimes took classes back to back to back around dinner time, marveling at how my hunger would dissipate after the first couple of songs, the bass drowning out the growl of my stomach. I also noticed how, as I raised money for various charitable causes through road races, the difference between non-disabled runners and the recipients of their fundraising was often depicted as troublingly stark. The runners, altruistic, athletic heroes, and the disabled or ill, forlorn, frail charity cases. At Lululemon, I was compensated only with literal exposure, born of the snug leggings and sports bras I earned for teaching free classes among the rolling racks or for storefront window demonstrations, a living mannequin sweating behind glass pasted with Ayn Rand quotes and platitudes about upgrading your outlook. Many other brands soon also sold stretchy pants alongside an uncritical embrace of individualist fitspo that conveniently ignored the obstacles that prevent many from pursuing physical fitness and the elusiveness of the standard of thriving, not just surviving. So much of this whole world was blindingly white. And even if women figured prominently as workers and consumers, the owners, investors, and managers were overwhelmingly men. I knew the gym could germinate collective and individual transformation, but it could just as powerfully reproduce the many inequalities of American life outside the gym and create new ones. I have spent the last decade figuring out how we got here, and this book traces processes that originated more than a century ago. Yet it was the coronavirus pandemic, which came late in this project, that has both posed the biggest challenges to contemporary fitness culture and revealed how embedded its assumptions and practices have become in American life. Almost overnight, thousands of brick-and-mortar fitness establishments went dark in March 2020. And in those last days before the shutdowns, going to the gym had morphed from a virtuous act to a narcissistic one that actually threatened public health. On the September day when New York City gyms reopened, I lined up around the block at 5:45 a.m. with other Equinox members who also radiated excitement at returning to what had once been an ordinary ritual but now felt almost exotic. After temperature checks, we streamed, masked, into a fitness funhouse filled not only with strangers but long unused hulking equipment, squat racks, treadmills, Pilates reformers, a solid wood bar drilled into a mirrored wall. Given the far more momentous tragedy, participating in such a sweaty spectacle felt indulgent, not least because just months before, freezer trucks had lined the sidewalk in front of the hospital across the way. Countless small studios operating on thin margins had closed during the pandemic, while Equinox, with its private equity funding, had endured. The fitness industry nationwide lost 44% of its jobs, with 17% of its businesses permanently shuttering by the end of 2020. The crisis brought together cosmopolitan entrepreneurs and suburban gym owners. There is no curbside pickup for fitness, IHRSA, the International Health Racket and Sports Club Association, the industry's trade organization, pled in support of a federal bill that requested $30 billion of relief appropriations. I called and tweeted in support of this measure, the Gyms Mitigation and Survival Act, as well as the related Personal Health Investment Today Act, which allows Americans to use pre-tax dollars for physical activity-related expenses, such as gym memberships, fitness equipment, and youth sports fees. But their framing reveals a fundamental weakness. They fail even to recognize, much less redress, the lack of public investment in physical education and recreational fitness. Couldn't bipartisan support for the importance of exercise be an opportunity to consider a new framework for the provision of fitness? Members of a high-end gym typically had access to online alternatives, proximity to safe outdoor space, and more room to exercise at home, as well as relative control over their schedules. In many cities, however, public basketball courts, parks, playgrounds, and beaches, not to mention schools and children's sports leagues, were closed. People who skirted regulations to enjoy the sun and sand, play frisbee in the park, organize children's sports, or go for a run were often condemned for their irresponsible disregard for health. Giving a seminar for physical educators gearing up for another pandemic school year, I learned that despite the boom in digital fitness, it was becoming harder than ever to convince people that physical education in even a constrained form, online, mass, distanced, or without balls passed between children, was worth the effort or risk. The existence of that excited pre-dawn lineup outside Equinox revealed how encoded exercise had become as essential. Yet the collective failure to fight for its public provision only underscored that fitness is seen primarily as a consumer good rather than a human right. Exercise is no longer just working out in the narrow physical sense, but neither is it working out as the collective public project it might be. Charting how and why these histories have unfolded is imperative to imagining and making a more equal future. I hope you're experiencing this author's note as a sort of warm-up, even if that phrasing makes me seem too invested in exercise. No pursuit of truth is ever perfectly unbiased, and certainly I am that person always up for a workout, and I do believe that a world in which more people have more opportunities to exercise on their own terms is one worth fighting for. I'm also a white-presenting woman in a straight-sized, non-disabled body, which absolutely affects my interactions with the world in and out of the gym. My expertise in American political culture equips me with the credentials to write this book, but my intimate connection to this subject has pushed me to reflect more deeply than ever on how my experience and identity shape my scholarship and has given me an appreciation of nuance and emotion that more clinical analyses can lack. Because I, like any reader, have not been personally subject to every sort of discrimination rampant in our culture in general and in fitness spaces in particular, I have labored to emphasize how these biases have been constructed and perpetuated. Furthermore, my experiences working out and in fitness environments, from school gyms to store windows to locker rooms to fancy studios to community centers, have led me to interviews and archives publicly unavailable, a boon to this project, but also a circumstance that means I explore more deeply certain topics, individuals, and phenomena to the exclusion of others. No history that spans a huge nation over more than a century can be exhaustive, and I believe this in-depth approach is more intellectually satisfying than a sprawling but ultimately shallow alternative. I hope that this chronicle of how we became a nation obsessed with exercise but insensible to the power of both its oppressive dimensions, pains, and life-changing joys, gains, can help make these processes and underlying assumptions visible, and thus strengthen us to fight for a better path forward at the gym and in the world. Introduction. What is the Fit Nation? When Justin Pritchett finally decided to call the cops on an October evening in 2017, the manager of a Skokie, Illinois export fitness franchise had had enough. No matter how vigilantly he watched the reception area, securing every entrance and exit, that kid just kept showing up, running the length of the basketball court with his friends or pumping weights on the gym floor. Almost like a magic show, Pritchett later told the press, 15-year-old Vincent Gonzalez would just randomly appear, not walking past the front desk. Veteran police officer Mario Valenti answered Pritchett's frustrated call reporting trespassing, but he didn't arrest, fine, or remove Gonzalez, who had been an export member until he could no longer afford the fees. Noting Gonzalez's gentle nature, Valenti offered the teenager $150 of his own money to put toward a membership. Export executives were charmed, and they supplemented Valenti's gift to cover a 2-year membership for Gonzalez, valued at around $700. Thanks to this generosity, Gonzalez's mother gushed, Vincent could focus on his studies at his charter high school, free to work out without worrying about the cost or, for that matter, a police record. Most newsmaking incidents that involve calling the cops on young men of color take a different turn, and the internet thrilled at this unbelievably positive story. But the export story raises crucial questions about fitness in the 21st century United States. One, Why does Vincent's committed quest to exercise, to the point of lawbreaking, so pull at our heartstrings? And two, if it resonates because we believe that exercise is integral to everyday life, why are we satisfied with and even celebrating the fact that it is seen as a private good, with access to it resting on the arbitrary altruism of a good-humored police officer or health club executive? The answers to both of these questions lie in the history of the last 75 years, during which an astonishingly expansive consensus about the importance of exercise has emerged in America. Working out evolved from a strange, even suspicious pursuit to a social imperative, embraced as crucial by Americans otherwise increasingly divided by identity and ideology. Today, it's almost impossible to open one's inbox or walk a few city blocks without experiencing some exhortation to exercise. Walk 5K to cure cancer, ignite your inner sex kitten at pole dancing class, sweat like a celebrity at SoulCycle. Even resisting these fitness trends often involves embracing others. Harden the fuck up at a CrossFit anti-gym, join the defiantly size-inclusive fat kid dance party, or breathe deeply into the blissful escape of downward dog. Fitness has become a figurative backdrop for much of contemporary life. An intrepid reporter breaks a story by taking Pilates alongside an inscrutable source. A CEO confides that her hiring secret is observing how applicants perform in a spin class. Little girls make yoga mats for their American Girl dolls. Fitbit data solves a murder. The list goes on. Exercise is everywhere. Except when it's not. As pressure to exercise has ratcheted up to a moral imperative, while also fueling a $37 billion industry, so too have free or subsidized fitness options failed to keep up. Fitness is a slippery concept, but it is hard to deny that the United States is far from physically fit by any number of measures. Only 20% of Americans work out consistently, over half of gym members barely use their expensive facilities, and fewer than 3 out of 10 high school students get 60 minutes of exercise per day. Socioeconomic status only intensifies this phenomenon. 80% of Americans live in a fitness desert, defined as an area without a public park in a half-mile radius. Physical education is often summarily cut from under-resourced schools or taught by an educator without specialized training. Yet the field has become so anemic that schools struggle to find physical educators for the few positions that do exist. Even as the United States remains so much the locus of global commercial fitness that Parisian exercise studios market New York City boot camps and California bodies, this country attracts international attention for its relentlessly rising obesity rates, which are especially pronounced among the poor and people of color. Social critics rightly reject the moral panic over the obesity epidemic as being driven by fat hatred trussed up as genuine health concerns, especially in perpetuating the idea that fat people are always unfit and that obesity is always the underlying cause of ill health. But it is worth asking whether Americans have the freedom, flexibility, and safe physical spaces to be active in the ways that they would choose. The pandemic has worsened the situation, as economic insecurity and the enforced sedentariness of quarantines has made regular exercise an even greater rarity among those with less autonomy over their time and space, and by extension, their bodies. By contrast, exercise signifies affluence. Gyms, especially in their boutique studio form, a super luxury 21st century invention that was the industry's fastest growing segment before the pandemic, and that even since has continued to attract private equity investment and spawn IPOs, cluster in wealthy neighborhoods. Many white-collar employees enjoy workplace wellness programs, health club memberships subsidized by private insurance, and enough control over their work schedules to be able to incorporate exercise into their day. Fitness has become not only a physical pursuit, but a ubiquitous accoutrement of an aspirational lifestyle promoted by celebrities, online influencers, and the everyday people who emulate them on social media. Glistening selfies taken after a waitlist-only spin class, destination marathons, expensive athleisure clothing, a $2,500 stationary bike, or a fitness concierge who will plan, book, and accompany you to your workout. Actual exercise instructions sold separately. Money and motivation are necessary but not sufficient for full participation of what I style the Fit Nation. How a person's body is perceived can lock or unlock social benefits and more. One self-described fat, Black, queer woman who is an experienced runner described the patronizing encouragement she regularly endures when people in fitness contexts wrongly assume, due to her looks, that she is just getting started. Wearing pricey technical gear or a t-shirt from a prestigious college, she and other people of color have found, can temper the condescension that greets a body assumed to be an outsider to gyms, race expos, or fitness studios. The sports bra, a Nike designer gushed to me, is the new t-shirt, a trend that not only telegraphs a wearer's constant readiness to hit the gym, but also presumes the confidence and desire to display arms and abdominals in a world that harshly judges big bodies. Whiteness and leanness aren't always enough. One writer traded triathlons for lifting and realized that his friends and even his wife were vaguely disgusted by his bulging muscles. Members of his professional class were supposed to look like wiry endurance athletes, not hulking laborers. Despite or because of greater attention to inequality, fitness has become a socially acceptable form of conspicuous consumption in a society that celebrates the pursuit of health as practically holy, but not quite enough to make it a public good. This book explains how we arrived here. Over more than a century, activists, entrepreneurs, educators, policymakers, and individuals have created, participated in, and resisted the Fit Nation, a society in which exercise infiltrates practically every quarter of American life, in both problematic and promising ways, but in which full, autonomous participation depends on spending power rather than citizenship. It wasn't always like this. This story of how exercise went from being a peculiar pursuit of the few to a universal preoccupation begins on the stage of the 1893 Chicago World's Fair, where strongman Eugene Sandow preened and flexed at a time when sculpted muscles and exhibitionism made strong men and women freaks and even sexual deviants. Who else would spend so much time working on their body and immodestly displaying it? But over time, these strong men and women sold the idea of exercise as a virtuous form of self-discipline, available to anyone willing to send away for a free pamphlet and to do the work it prescribed. Complemented by a generation of physical educators who sought to fortify cerebral university students and office workers and to discipline the unruly bodies of immigrants and non-white minorities, exercise was becoming an everyday activity. By the early 1950s, on Santa Monica's Muscle Beach, crowds of tourists did more than gaze at suntanned acrobats and weightlifters. They began to seriously entertain the idea that exercise might not be the stuff of sideshows, but an activity they might, even should, pursue. It was a White Plains homemaker named Bonnie Pruden, not a strapping bodybuilder, who first sounded the alarm that American children displayed a disturbing lack of fitness to the peril of the nation. Pruden and others argued that economic abundance was making Americans lazy and weak, too reliant on push-button luxuries and the easy car and television-centric life of the suburbs. A generation of white middle-class children was growing up ill-equipped to fight should the Cold War get hot, their flabby bodies hardly advertising the supremacy of the American way of life. President Dwight Eisenhower established the Presidential Council on Youth Fitness to take on this issue as one of military preparedness. His handsome, youthful successor, John F. Kennedy, however, proved a better poster boy for exercise, and he amplified Eisenhower's condemnation of corporeally and intellectually soft Americans as a national security threat. Unlike Eisenhower, though, he presented fitness as fun, even glamorous, and for everyone. Such federal efforts at slimming the soft American through partnerships with local agencies, celebrities, athletes, and industry powerfully instilled the idea that exercise was a positive, even moral act. Yet, though neither the federal government nor local agencies ever invested sufficiently in infrastructure and anti-poverty policies to support this goal, the programs they did support brought about a huge shift in sensibility, transforming the pursuit of physical fitness from a suspicious pastime of narcissistic deviance to a requirement of self-fulfillment and civic life. A generation of exercise entrepreneurs, many hailing from Muscle Beach, profitably commodified this positive new image of exercise, spreading it far and wide through the first chain gyms that sought a clientele beyond male weightlifters and bodybuilders. A far cry from dank weight rooms, many new facilities further sanitize the image of exercise by linking it with affluence, beauty, and science, enticing women and families to join palaces with bowling alleys, wall-to-wall carpet, tropical fish tanks, spas, and state-of-the-art equipment. Of course, many Americans could not afford private memberships, failed the presidential fitness challenge, or outright rejected the Cold War conformism and materialism that was at the heart of
Sample complete. Ready to continue?